I've experienced the strangest enshittification to date, which is so, like, around Christmas time, I make mince tarts and you get like your mince meat in a jar. And last year, I bought a different mince meat than I would normally buy. And Charlotte told me that she just didn't like the filling. She really preferred the previous mince meat filling. And I went out, I spent all day today. I went to multiple grocery stores, and there's only the one Robertson's mince meat at all grocery stores. And I looked on the internet, and apparently, whatever other competitor to Robertson's got bought out by like a larger conglomerate, and it wasn't cost effective enough, so they discontinued it. And so now in Canada, you can only get Robertson's mincemeat, apparently.
So strange.
So now I'm gonna have to learn how to make my own mincemeat because nobody wants to eat these Robertson mincemeat filled tarts.
I had a similar, like a related kind of experience. So I was making some cookies for a gluten-free friend, and I was talking to them about like what can you eat that's okay? And I landed on mini M&Ms. And
Okay.
they were saying, like, as long as you get a package and the package doesn't have a specific gluten warning on it, then it should be fine for me. So I'm like, that's easy. Mini M&Ms are like super available during the holiday season because they're very popular. I went to four different chain supermarkets, right? Different chains. And
Right.
I could not find a single bag of mini M&Ms.
Wow.
I could only find them in bulk, which is what I already had. And I was like, what is going on? Like, even M&Ms in general were strangely missing. There were no red and green M&M bags.
Oh,
Like, I'm like,
really?
this is kind of, just odd. Just odd.
Yeah,
Yeah. It could be related to chocolate futures, maybe. But that was like the first real unavailability that I'd encountered for it.
Like, I don't know if this has anything to do with AI, but the like I make curry all the time, and the fastest way to make curry that's good is to get the jars of curry paste. Curry sauce has to have preservatives in it so that the medium that the paste is in will last on a shelf. But curry paste is just the paste, and then you add like the dairy or equivalent of your choice. So it like goes farther and tastes better. And my main supermarket like only has the sauce now, like from the same producer, they're from the same company. They just stopped carrying the paste. And so now I have to go all the way to like a different town to
Oh.
get to go to an Indian supermarket where they have all the pastes.
Yeah.
So I
A
don't know.
turbulent world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
The holidays get even crazier.
speaking of living in the future, we have a book
Oh,
that is actually not set in the future. It's set in the present, essentially.
more or
It was
less,
written
an
at a
AU.
time when this would be the future.
I mean, I think I want to live in this world more than the one we're currently in.
Yeah, they have trains. They have light rail expanding in Minneapolis, so let's go there.
Easy. Okay, so our book this week is O Human Star by Blue Delaquanti. We're going to do two episodes on this. This episode is going to be on just volume one, or at least the spoilers will just be for volume one. So, spoiler alert, we are talking about everything that happens in volume one in this episode, and then next episode, we'll talk about the rest of the series.
And the rest.
Well, volumes two and three, because there's three volumes. So this was originally a web comic. It's still a web comic. You can read the whole thing on the website, which I will link in the show notes. Blue is an artist from Minneapolis, which is where the story is set, so that makes sense. They've done a couple of other books. We did an episode on Meal, which was the book about, it was a fictional story, but with like a non-fiction theme, I guess you could say. It was about eating insects. And they've also done a book I haven't read called Across a Field of Starlight, which I only just found out about when I was like Googling for more information about Blue. So now
Yeah.
I gotta check that out.
I know. I haven't read it yet either. I'm sorry. I really need to get it.
Yeah, and then they've also done lots of mini comics and short comics for anthologies. They did a Ghostbusters comic.
Whoa, wait, what?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't look into it too deeply. I think it was obviously a licensed thing with a publisher that needed an artist or something like that. But the like Blue's short stories, a lot of them are in Iron Circus anthologies, and that's always the one that I'm always looking forward to. Like, oh, I can't wait till I get to the short story that Blue has done because I know it's always going to be good. O Human Star won a Prism Award in 2018. I think that's all I have to say about Blue. I guess we have to do character building questions, don't we? All right, so I think I'm going to change my character building question now based on how we started this episode. What is the most frustrating encounter you've had with something that is not AI but is labeled as AI?
Like,
Well,
not AI, not
the
so there
things that
is
people
no
say,
AI,
because, like, I know,
Jody.
exactly, that's what I mean.
Oh, okay. So like we're working off the understanding that basically everything currently being labeled as AI is not AI.
Essentially,
Like
yeah.
the way that now we've partitioned this off is, oh no, like robots that can think for themselves is AGI, so everything else is AI is kind of how it's being marketed to
Oh, is
us right now.
that what they're doing now? Okay, now you know what? Because, like, part of the
Artificial
reason I picked
general
this
intelligence.
question is.
I still want to push back on
Anyways,
that. I
yeah.
don't
No,
like it.
sorry. I'm just trying to define the parameters so I understand the
Yeah. No,
question.
I mean, part of
No,
the reason
it's
I'm
like,
asking
okay,
this.
so your encounter with something marketed as AI, let's say.
Yeah.
I think I have one.
Okay.
So ironically, or maybe not ironically, in my company, in my job, I was assigned to be one of the people in the company. So it's like one of like 20 people in a company of about 2,000 to evaluate whether we should bring on Copilot AI for the purposes of improving our work at the company. And they could not have chosen a more antagonistic person, I think, for this purpose, but they chose me somehow. I think because in the past, as we've brought it up and I spoke on it, or as we've been speaking on it, my boss maybe noted that I could speak intelligently on it, like I have been keeping up with it and its development throughout the years. So anyway, I decided to give it a fair shot. You know, I'm like, okay, you say this is going to improve my actual work, so let's do it. Whatever I was doing that day, I tried to get the AI to help me. And it just setting it up as a demonstration to my superiors that it is not ready yet. And so the funniest one I came up with is I had to set up some finite element analysis on a design. I'm a mechanical engineer in my day job, for anyone who doesn't know. And finite element analysis is a computational, like it is, you could almost just think of it as a type of machine learning on itself, but it analyzes the forces in something to give you a visual representation of how the thing you're designing would perform under various conditions. And I had to set this up with a different department. So I said, okay, you know what? AI, why don't you give me a structure for this device? I'm setting it up for some finite element analysis. And let me know if you can connect with Windchill, which is the name of the program where we store different versions of the file. And so it generate very confidently generated me this whole big presentation, factoring like the wind factor and like wind speed and chilling of it. And I was like very perplexed at first because this is a device that will never go outside. It sits on a table and has some fluid going in and out of it until I realized that it had picked up on the name of the program that we used to store file, and it's like, oh, you need the wind chill. You need the wind chill. We got to get that in there. It was like, oh, Anyway, It was not a very successful test, let's say. And I'm jam.
Oh man. Well, I actually it's kind of nice to hear case studies of some of the Copilot and some of these other AI tools because I mean, I don't know. I've been trying to avoid a lot of this AI stuff because it just seems to really rub me the wrong way. But I think, me and AI got off on the wrong foot because of all the generative image making tools, which as an instructor in visual arts gets super frustrating, even more so, because then all your students just want to cut corners and it always seems to look bad. And like, I have a whole spiel where I tell people not, I just don't want AI generated images, like, period. Like, do not do this. Just, I don't care. I just don't use it in my course. And like, I still get people asking if they can use it, which I at least appreciate them asking, or people just straight up handing in things that were clearly generated, which honestly, what I've been doing a lot of times with that is just, I will point out all the problems and the inconsistencies in the art that was submitted, and I give them a bad mark. I'm like, well, this character doesn't look like anything like the character on the other page. Like, there's no art consistency here. This is bad. And I give them a bad mark. I don't even address the fact that they used AI, even though maybe I should. But the most frustrating thing that came up was I had a student who came up to me and like he was trying to do a package design for like suites, like these Thai suites. This is like pre-existing. These are real suites that they make in Thailand. You buy a box of them. So he's designing packaging for this box of sweets. And I was like, oh, okay, sure. And he's like, yeah, well, can I use AI to generate like the like sweets? Like, so that I can like put the label on the box. Like, I just want to use AI to generate the box of sweets. I'm like, well, couldn't you just find an image? And he's like, well, yeah, but couldn't I just generate an image with like Midjourney? And I was like, no, but like, have you searched the entire internet? Like, has no one ever taken a photo of these sweets? Like, have you looked on Unsplash? And like, he's just like, no, but could I just generate it with a prompt? And like, he just like wouldn't let it go. And it was so frustrating because it's like, I don't know. I always think now about like extractive versus generative, right? It's like when you do a Google search, it's extractive. You're extracting pre-existing information. And when you're doing like Midjourney, it's generative. You're creating new information, right? And like the fact that he's trying to use generative for something that exists. Like, I've had students pitch me where like they're trying to create something that does not exist. I'm like, okay, well, there's a case to be made because this image does not exist. But like you're trying to use generative to replace extractive, but like the information's there, you're just too lazy to find it, right? Like that's what's super frustrating for me. Anyways, my name's Jeff and I'm incredibly frustrated about AI.
Okay, so I'm JD. I have a few stories, and I'm gonna pick one that's a little more fun. So I'm an elementary school teacher, and last year, I had a student. We were doing like a writing assignment. They were supposed to write a story, not a long story, just like short story. And I had a student who, like, he's legitimately a very good writer. He does not necessarily write well on command. Like when you say, "I want as an assignment done, it needs to be like this," and it's like, "No, I can't do that for you." But like he knows how to write, so this is not a case of because the argument that people will make is like, "Oh, AI can help people who just lack the skills." It's like supporting like disabilities or whatever. Like, no, it's not. We have t technology for that already. So I give him this assignment. He eventually hands in a story, but then I'm reading it and it's got all these like Lord of the Rings characters in it. And this kid has not read Lord of the Rings. Like, that's not the current fandom that any 10-year-old is interested in. So I immediately clocked back, you did not write this. You got a computer to write this for you, and the only reason you got as far as us having this conversation where I've read it now is that I know you can write a story at exactly the speed. Like, you could have written a story in this time, and instead you got the internet to write it for you. And so I made him redo it.
It must be a total minefield being a teacher in this time.
Well, most of this is like suddenly the fact that we are way behind in terms of technology because computers cost too much and we never have enough to go around and we have to do everything on paper. Suddenly that's an advantage.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
Oh, I mean, like it's very different in the post-secondary world because like there's internal debates where like some instructors are like, this is it. It's the future. Like, it doesn't matter how we feel about it. It doesn't matter if it's good or if it's bad. The industry has pivoted here. Therefore, like, we owe it to our students to like address this, that like, the industry's made up its mind. So now we have to follow industry is kind of like how some instructors approach this, just unquestioningly. And then it's just such a mess because this is why I wanted you to kind of define what you meant at the beginning, because like, I mean, it's AI, everything gets labeled AI and it does so many different things. Like I do endorse some of the AI tools in Adobe Premiere when I teach that because like they have really good tools for automatically generating subtitles and like
Or
nobody
like
wants to do
picking out
that
the
job.
background or something like that.
And
Like,
like related to that, like I mentioned that we use technology for people who have challenges with writing, like it wasn't that long ago that we didn't have like an easy way to record speech to text. Like that was an expensive program you had to get a grant to pay for because we don't have money for stuff like that.
right.
And now it's just built into Microsoft and it's so incredibly useful. Like
Right.
that's worthwhile. And I'm sure there's some like large language learning model in there somewhere in order for it to function, but it's not built on theft and it is actually helpful.
In my work, certainly, like computerized tools are vital, like the type of mathematical modeling that we're doing, like finite element analysis, could benefit from some predictive algorithms, like taking a course, what you would call it, like a course finite element analysis, and we're making extrapolating based on that data. If we were to make it more fine, what would it look like? Because the finer you make it, the more processing power that takes. But if they could just infer from what else we know, that could be very useful. We use a ton of translation services at our company. Being able to like quickly translate things is really vital. And Excel, like mathematical models in Excel, transformed the way engineering is done. And that was a huge leap forward several decades ago. But so it's like I'm not antagonistic to it in concept, but I am in this particular execution. But it's really funny, JD, because this question reminded me, as I was reading O Human Star, about how different this felt and how different the future of this type of technology felt back in 2019. And I was really into it. So, like, even the phrase generative art meant something completely different in 2019. And it was exciting and new, and like a computer taking an algorithm and creating something from math alone. Was tremendously exciting and was creating something worth talking about. And the context has shifted completely. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. Oh, thanks for bringing us back around to Oh Human Star. I was about to be like, welcome to the Trade Waiters where we debate the merits of AI technology. But I definitely felt that reading volume one. Like I was just there was a couple times where they talked about generative art and algorithms, and I was viscerally my body was just like, oh, and then I was like, no, this is different. This is like before all the stuff got like so tainted by these tech bros.
Yeah, the original the flashback, let's say, the flashback period of time and the modern period of time. The flashback period of time was 2002, and the context in 2002 was wildly different. Like this was, if you think about a person in 2002 thinking about these things, it was completely speculative at that time. That was Excel, Excel.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to make that the question, because this is a frustration I felt when reading this book is like I really like the conversation that I feel a lot of science fiction authors were having like prior to a few years ago about like what would it be like to have like an actual artificial intelligence. Like, how much would that be like us, and how much would it be different from us? And like, what can we extrapolate from the experience of being human to what it would be like to be a completely non-human intelligence? And I think that's still, there's like lots of open questions there still, because we don't have any of that technology yet. But I feel like it's so much harder to have that conversation now when we have lost all the terminology to this like sideshow.
LLM.
Huckster.
The large language model, I think, is there's so much being hung on these large language models and whether or not chaining strings of words together is reasoning or not. And it's interesting because this is something that I've paid attention to for a long time, both as a fan of science fiction and as a engineer and scientist in this space. And it's interesting to recall that it was not only AI as like its capability to transform the future, but there's also this parallel conversation about the quote unquote singularity. And that's where we get to AGI, right? So we brought this back in. But the conversations around the singularity were also very different back in 2019, and what it meant for understanding of human consciousness and how that would transform society. And I think that's explored in an interesting way in this book as well, in a different way. And it's interesting that there's been a recent news item where they test these LLMs on metrics of what they consider human-like intelligence. And there was recently a score that one of the private, not yet released LLM models scored higher than a human. And people are saying like this could be considered a metric of AGI. And I was so it's funny to be discussing this right now. It's December 2024, but I don't buy it. We'll see.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
mean, we had the Turing test for decades. That was the test that people would say, like, since Alan Turing, like, this is how you can tell whether something is an artificial intelligence or not. And like, chatbots breeze past the Turing test like a decade ago. 'Cause I think that just means it's not a very effective test.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. The Turing test was never meant to be like an all or nothing. It was just an
Yeah.
indicator.
Sure.
I
Yeah, but
mean,
I mean the idea is with the Turing test is that if you can be in a conversation with a robot and you can't tell that it's a robot, it must be artificially intelligent, or maybe it's artificially intelligent. Turns out that humans are just really, really good at imagining we're talking to a person.
yeah.
Like,
Well, this is, I mean,
that's one of our special skills that most species don't have, is like we are excellent at
We are
imagining there's another
champion
person in the room.
anthropomorphizers.
Yeah, this is, I mean, but it is like there's this bias that I don't know if we can ever overcome where, like I think way back when there was computers that you would put cassette tapes in, like, or punch cards, there was like someone made a therapist bot or something, and people were just like, oh, this thing's super smart. This thing really understands me. And it's like, no, it's just a series of punch cards. You've read all of this into it. It's like even what's that like the sign language gorilla, right? It's just like
Oh, Coco.
Coco the gorilla. Like people thought Coco was saying all this stuff, but that was just their bias. Like Coco just wanted to eat some food, and Coco knew that if Coco moved their hands and fingers around, the humans would like applaud and like give her snacks. Like, like we ascribed all this like extra intelligence, and it was really just like this bias we have where we can only perceive things as being human like us. We can't think that like, oh, this other living being might have like a different internal life than ours. It like has to think on the same lines as us. It has to have the same motivations we have. Like, yeah, it's such a, anyways, we're
Yeah,
like,
just as
we're not equipped to judge this stuff.
as a side note, the program you referenced earlier, the CBT program, the therapist program was called ELISA. And it was something, it was a very interesting case study. So if anyone wants to look that up earlier, it was actually, it demonstrated, it wasn't meant to demonstrate computer intelligence, but it did demonstrate the effectiveness of CBT, even if you're not getting that detailed of response. Just something prompting you continuously, like, oh, well, how does that make you feel? Was actually considered quite therapeutically effective at the time.
Interesting.
Okay.
Okay, we really need to talk about this book, though.
I mean,
Yeah,
sorry. We're talking about
no,
this, we're talking about this book in galaxy brain terms, so let's bring it back
this
down to
is all related. I'm glad we've got two episodes because there's a lot to unpack here. What did you think of this book? I'm the one who picked this.
Oh man, this is one of my favorite books, I think. Like the second you suggested it, I was like, yeah, I'll read that again 100%. I think this would be my third time reading the whole series. I read it first as a web comic, then once I bought the trades, I read it again and I was just as happy reading it a third time. It's one of the comics I feel that is so good it makes me mad about how good it is. I just get I get ah, oh, Blue, damn it. This is so good. Damn it, Blue.
I mean, it's yeah, it's great. It's great comic making. It's really compelling. I like, yeah, I'm actually glad I got to reread this because I think rereading because I read volume one and two a long time ago, and then I finally got to finish reading the whole series now because I got my volume three. Showed up in the mail just in time because the Canada Post strike ended. But I think, yeah, rereading this, I think originally, I don't know, I think I originally was very like, oh, this is like a fun science fiction story. And like, it is a fun science fiction story, but like, I think rereading it, I was like, oh, wow, there's like a lot more queer subtext that just went right over my head the first time I read this.
Oh,
And
interesting.
I was kind of, I feel like I was approaching this with fresh eyes, reading it a second time now, and I really enjoyed rereading it. Yeah.
Yeah, every time I read it, I pick up on even more foreshadowing. And I think just it's so impressive as a webcomic. Like something that really struck me about it is webcomics run the gamut, in terms of be one of the things that are amazing about them is that they are very accessible. They remove the gatekeeper level. And so as a result, it's very common for web comics to have writers who indulge in their characters a little bit, take like side quests with them and just enjoy writing their characters and what they want to write. Whereas this felt just so laser focused and efficient from page one in a way that is really incredible. It was fascinating picking up on so much foreshadowing from page one that carries through the entire series in a way that I think is really masterfully done.
Yeah,
Yeah, like I feel like that's something that can only really be appreciated once you've read the whole series is how like every piece has its place, but you're not getting them in the right order. Like it seems like such a almost like an obvious thing to do as a writer, like oh, your story is more interesting if you just present it in the wrong order, but that's not an easy thing to accomplish, right? It's easy
Yeah.
to say, not easy to do. Especially in a web comic that's like multiple volumes worth of graphic novel. Like I there's a lot of graphic novels that are good at that can like present things in a different order just because the whole thing has been written in advance and it's been edited down before it reaches its final form. But to have that in a multi-volume web comic, like that is super rare. I can't think of another example of that. And it's just it makes like it raises the bar for what you can expect from a piece of writing.
I think so.
Yeah. It's I mean, yeah, I think I didn't realize it was a web comic when I first picked it up, and I agree, like it's a very tight plot. Like there is no wasted space. And in fact, if I had any criticisms, I think it was more just like that there were like little side things where I was like, oh, it'd be fun to explore that. It would be fun to see more of these other aspects of this world and to see more of these other side characters, but like that would just meander and like lose the point. So like it's like everything that needs to be there is there, and I think that's a testament to like like the editing or like the like whatever the writing process at the beginning, like Blue clearly just knew the important points and stuck to them and didn't
It takes so
meander.
much discipline, like the discipline of making a comic, the discipline of serializing it online at a regular schedule, and the discipline of like staying away from what's basically catnip to writers, you know? It's incredible to me.
And to do that without a publishing deal at the start.
Yeah, without editorial oversight.
Like I feel like as I was reading this, I didn't feel like I was missing out on any side quests. Like it's partly because it's such a long series. Like there's lots of time to just spend time with the characters, getting to know them. And that's my favorite part. Like I love science fiction, but I more than anything, I love science fiction where you care about the characters, because that's not a guarantee in science fiction at all.
Yeah. And this did feel very character driven. I agree with
Oh,
that.
100%. This is like for me, this is the perfect story where it's that combination of like it's speculative science fiction. You have a whole world you can build up to suit your theme, however you please, but then the actual story is about just these characters. That's what I want, and that's exactly what this story does.
Yeah, super fun. I love the characters in this book. They're all so different. And they're also unique, and they each bring something essential to the story. Like you have Al, you have Brandon, you have Sola, and you have everyone brings something completely different to the mix. Blue is really adept at creating characters that look distinctive. Like there's never e even the fact that Al and Sola ostensibly are supposed to have the same face, you can read that, and yet you're never going to get them confused.
Like that's something like there are a few cartoonists who are really good at that, like Carlos Speed McNeil comes to mind, of like being able to have similar but different faces. But yeah, for sure that was something I noticed, is like, oh, they have the same nose. That's important. That's important to the story.
Good, definitely good distinct character designs, and like just really fun use of color. We were talking about color before we started recording, but like I have really gotten on board with limited palette. I think limited palette works so well for comics, and like I don't know. I still find myself falling into the full color trap, but I recognize that like the trick here is you've got to like figure out your like two or three key colors and just really stick to your guns. And the way Blue uses the color to help you with the timeline, right? So the flashbacks are in red and the current timeline is in blue, and then well, we're not there yet, but like green shows up and has significance. And it's like, it's just such a smart way of telling a story. I think more cartoon is my advice to any young cartoonist, is just like do a two color design and just like stick to it. Just stick to your two colors.
Yeah, you mentioned that in one of our podcasts recently, and I have to admit, it has been like I have been turning that over in my head quite a bit, Jeff. Like, yeah, limited palette really works well for comics specifically.
Yeah, it unifies the page because inevitably you've got multiple panels of art. So you can't, it like the wider your palette, you're just like, if there's too many colors, you're just overwhelmed by them because you're looking at more than one image at a time. So
Yeah, I
like
think.
limiting your colors, like really sort of sim I don't know how to explain it, but yeah, it simplifies
It
it makes
helps.
it more readable.
It helps. Yeah, it helps make focus, right? Because then you're not masking things with too much color, and it's like oh, I'm trying to. I feel like I'm cribbing off someone else, and I can't remember. But like, it's like an oil painting. You're supposed to stand there and just stare at it for like an hour and take in all the details. But like comics, you're supposed to go to the next panel, right? And
Yeah,
so like you want.
there's a tempo to how you're reading that is vital to the experience. You're absolutely right.
And also, like if you're looking at a single image, like an oil painting, like you have a composition within that panel that's like this here's the part you're supposed to look at first, where you're doing that with color. Like you look here and then you look at these other things. Whereas with a comic, you have to have multiple points of focus on a single page. And so if you're limiting your colors, you're forced to do that in other ways than like, here's the red, here's the orange thing you're looking at. Oh, here's the orange thing you're looking at again. Oh, here's the orange thing you're looking at. And then it all kind of flattens out.
If you think of like that, if there was just an orange element as you're describing, if you had it multiple times on the page and you kind of like zoom out and you're looking at the page, all of the orange things are going to draw your focus at the same time. And guiding the reader's focus is really, really an important and delicate thing.
And there's some like really strong examples in here, like we get right from the start of the story, we get this sort of flashback where Al is dying, and the whole scene is done in blue, but then there's red blood, and like it's very judiciously placed. Like it's not in every panel, it's only in a couple of panels anytime we see it. And like that instantly draws your focus. Like it's immediate.
Do you want to summarize the plot like 30 seconds
Oh
for us?
yeah, I'll try.
Good
There's a lot
luck.
going on. Okay, so in volume one, we're introduced to Al Sterling, who is this brilliant inventor. He is the face of the company that has developed the first real artificial intelligence. Well, they have this device called an emulator that's basically a brain, but it's a robot brain. And first scene, we see his death. He dies. It's unclear why or how, but that's what happens. And then he wakes up and in like another room, but not knowing what's happened because he knows he was dying and he seems fine, but also he's now a robot, like a very well simulated or a very sort of like human-shaped robot, and he gets driven to the house of his business partner slash romantic partner Brendan, who has, as far as Brendan is concerned, Al has been dead for 16 years, and just he shows up on his doorstep with no explanation. Nobody knows, no one including Al knows how he got there. And he's just sort of thrown into this world 16 years later. Also, Brendan has a daughter, Sulla, who is also a robot. And I guess this is, we do find out in volume one that Sulla was originally, we do find this out, right, don't we? Yeah. That Sulla was originally based on a scan of Al's brain, in a desperate attempt to bring him back, but she has since gone in a very different direction in her life. For example, she is a girl and does, at least as far as we can tell in volume one, doesn't seem to be very much like Al at all. And then there's this sort of like open question of like what's going on, how did this happen. We also get a lot of backstory with how Al and Brendan met. Brendan was originally hired on as an employee when, or yeah, Brendan was originally hired on as an employee when Al was just kind of a one-man operation. And really, even though it's the company is called Sterling, Brendan is at least half of this company. Like he has done a lot of the work to build this, both on the technology side and in the business side. By the end of volume one, we get in the flashback, we get to a point where they are presenting their new device to the world, and everyone's very excited about it. And in the present timeline, we're just getting to know these characters. Sulla is has lived a fairly insular life, not being around, not spending a lot of time around kids her own age. But then she like goes and like meets some kids that she wants to spend time with. Meets Titus, who she has a crush on. And I mean, that's what am I missing? I'm sure I'm missing something.
No, that's about it. That's a
Okay.
good summary for volume one, I think. I just wanted to make sure it was there for the listener. But God, that first scene, I loved that first scene. I loved the quiet unfolding of the world. And the way Alistair reacts to it, I think, is just super interesting. He wakes up and he's like, I'm a robot. And he goes outside and there's two other robots and he's like, you're robots. And they're like, great, come with us. By the way, you've been dead for 16 years. And so he just goes in the car with them and they're like driving into the city. And it's slowly revealed that he somewhat knows both of these robots because one is based on the dancer that he had in his workshop, and the other apparently is sort of looking like a something he drew as a child, which I thought was really interesting as we learn more about this character. And he's dropped off with Brendan, and I found it just so fun how Brendan and Al are immediately at odds for really complex reasons. And Brendan, Al thinks Brendan brought him back. Brendan doesn't know who brought him back and is like, we have to get to the bottom of this, but also you're here and this is amazing. Ah, God, for an opener, it was just such a slam dunk.
So I have a question. When I first read this, I interpreted that scene as that this was Al committing suicide. And
Interesting, yeah.
that's not what happens. Like I can't remember whether it's in this volume or in another volume where we find out for sure that that is not what's going on. But I had got that impression from that scene, and I'm wondering what you both sort of thought of that.
It's hard to remember back to the very first time I read it, but as you mention it now, I do think I had the same impression. I thought like the implication felt like it was there.
I was just gonna say, like, I didn't immediately clock that as a suicide. Like, I mean, he started spitting up blood and like it seemed very shocking. Like, I almost wondered if he had been poisoned or murdered or something. I mean, it's a good opener, right? You kill your main character in the first like 2 pages, and then they get
You're
brought back
dead.
as a
Now
robot.
what?
Like, I mean, I will say that's I was locked in after the first five, like when I first got this book. I don't know when, but way back, and I actually have an autograph with a little drawing from Blue on my volume one, and like that after I read that first volume, like I was locked in right from that first little sequence. But I didn't see it as a suicide. No.
Okay. I think, like, looking back at that scene, I think the reason I thought that is because he leaves a note. But I guess that he knew he was dying is what it is, and that's why he's leaving a note. It was quick, but not planned, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I do feel like it sort of sets up a dynamic for his character, which is true about his character, but not a true accounting of that event, if that makes sense. Like there is a darker side to Al that is explored later on in the series that I feel like this scene, at least for me, it set this up as like there is this other side to him that we aren't going to find out until later.
I think that's true. I think even though he did not die by his own hand, there is a particular relationship that Al has to his own life that made his experience of dying different than what I would consider standard, if that makes sense. Like he had a deep self-loathing and a lot of issues with self-worth. And so as he died, you could imagine that perhaps he had certain ideas about that. And then coming back, it almost felt resentful to me.
Yeah.
That's definitely true. Like, well,
Absolutely.
this wasn't what I thought was going to happen. What's going on here?
Oh,
Who are you and why did you get to choose this for me?
That's a really good way to put it.
I just wanted to mention, JD, that I did go have a quick look at the first couple pages again, and the note on the bed is signed, or it it's signed, or, yeah, it has Al's name on it. I was wondering if, like,
Oh.
I didn't know if it was like signed by Al or if it was addressed to Al. So I was like, not sh like the note's a little more mysterious to me because I actually kind of read it as a note left for Al.
Yeah, we
The
never
first time
see
I
the
saw it?
note.
Yeah.
We never know its contents.
Yeah, it could have been Brandon running off for a period of time.
Yeah, could be. I think I had assumed that this was a note he was leaving to Brendan because this death was so sudden that there was no other way to communicate with him. But I don't
Yes.
know.
Yeah, I
It's
guess. See, if it was a note to Brendan, it would have said Brendan on the top of the note, right?
But
Or.
was it Al at the top of the note or was it
Yeah.
Al at the bottom of the note?
Right. Okay, that's
Not
true.
clear.
So, yeah, it's not clear.
Yeah.
Anyways.
That's fine. Not everything has to be clear. These are complicated characters. That's one of the things I like about them is how complicated they are.
Yeah.
But yeah, the other big like whammy at the beginning of the story is Sulla, right? And just this idea that like Brendan's like, "Oh, I tried to bring you back and the child version of you wanted to become a girl, and so now I have a daughter named Sulla who's sort of based on you, but is now like their own person." Like that was really a really interesting. I don't know. I've never seen a character written like that, right? Like I
I
think that's
can't
really
think of anything
fascinating, right?
remotely close. Yeah.
Like,
It's just such a wild concept. It's so cool.
and it's like this is, I think, what's great about science fiction, if you're doing it right, is that you can write a story like that, and it kind of makes sense because it's this world with robots in it. Like you can't write that in a quote unquote realistic setting and have it make sense. Like that's just not a story that's on the table for you without some kind of like supernatural or futuristic thing as a MacGuffin. And like I like what I one of the biggest things I like about science fiction is this ability for it to open up possible stories that can't exist otherwise.
It's so cool. I really liked this introduction with Sulla. Sulla is such a ray of sunshine. She's so cute. She's a happy 15-year-old, and I loved watching the dynamic between Sulla and Al and Brendan. So Brendan has really developed into a dad. He cares a lot about his daughter Sulla, and the way that those two interact is really quite cute and I thought like authentic. But Sulla and Al have like a very complex relationship right from the jump, where he's like he comes in, I guess like the best way you could describe that relationship is like a family friend slash uncle kind of relationship between the two. But then you have this complexity of Sulla kind of idolizes Al immediately because of what he represents in her history and her origin, even though she doesn't even understand the entirety of that origin story for herself.
Yeah,
And
like Brendan has not told Sulla the nature of his relationship with Al, but she does know that her brain was based on a scan of his.
And I thought it was really interesting how kind Al was to Sulla even from the beginning, despite the shock of learning that he had been resurrected without his consent or knowledge, and also that she turned out to be a girl. And the profound shock that gave him, he didn't let any of that come back to Sulla directly, I don't feel.
Yeah, which is really interesting considering how abrasive he is with most other people, including Brendan. Like, he is, like, of all the people in the world, he is maybe second nicest to Brendan, but that's a low bar.
No, I mean he like really jumps in there like after he kind of gets oriented, he really starts to be a mentor to Sulla, right? And when they go out into the city and like Sulla's like wants to meet teenagers and like Al is like, "Go, yeah, go for it. You should just go and talk to them." Like, "Yeah, I know you stick with your friends. You have fun. Like, I'm gonna take off." Like like I think he was being really supportive. I thought that was really cool,
Yeah, he obviously has like a. It's like, you ever get that question of like, what would you tell your younger self? And I feel like that reads really clearly in his relationship to Sulla. He feels like he's talking to his own younger self because she is that in a lot of ways. And he's basically delivering the type of kindness and advice that he wish he had directly received in his youth. Like he sees in her all of his regret more than anything else, I think.
And it's interesting, like, so much of the story, and we can talk about this more next episode too, but so much of the theme of the story seems to, or one of the possible themes, because I think there's more than one in this, is the idea of, like, okay, so we have this MacGuffin of, like, you can scan someone's brain and make a robot copy, but there is no assurance from that point that two people with the same brain will end up in the same place. And the sort of this divergent, like, two roads in a wood kind of scenario, like, you will get very different people. And that's
Yeah.
super interesting.
It speaks a lot to consciousness in general, right? Where it's like how much of you is ingrained and how much of you is your choices and your history.
And, like, even though, like, we don't have robots, we don't have, like, artificial intelligence, so that part isn't really relevant to the real world. Like, the question of, like, who are you and why are you the way you are, that is super relevant, and that's what makes a story like this so good.
Well, I mean, like, it also just makes sense that, like, I mean, Brendan can make a copy of Al, but he can't replicate all the different conditions of the childhood and the experiences that led this being to becoming Al, right? And so, like,
Nobody necessarily want
inevitably,
to, because
well,
Al's
yes.
childhood was apparently pretty rough.
Right. But I mean, you know, like, if you're trying to get an exact copy of Al, right? Like that's already just not going to happen because now you've got this same shaped body, but now it's being raised in like a more caring and supportive home. Like, you know, just inevitably, like different decisions are going to be made, different aspects of the personality are going to emerge. Like there are similarities. Like Sulla likes to tinker as much as Al does, right? Like there are definitely like through lines, but it's just like, yeah, like you are kind of the tapestry of all your experiences, and like, you know, you pull one thread, and like it's already like you're now a different person, right? Like you were never going to get a perfect copy of Al unless you took his brain at his death and just implanted in like another brain. If you're like trying to start over with like a child brain version of Al, you're going to get a different outcome, right?
And I think that's not really what Brandon was trying to do. At the time that he did it, he was using the resources that he had. He was trying to recreate Al as Al. And it's only the limitations of the hardware that he had at the time that made that impossible. And then you have this whole journey of Sulla becoming Sulla, which I think we don't see in this volume, but and so bring it back. That is exactly what they ended up doing. It's like, no, if you want the real exact Al, bring him back in his exact same body the way it was.
With all those memories, because that was one of the differences, was that Sulla didn't inherit all of Al's memories. Like, she doesn't know everything that Al knows.
Yeah, it was a degraded copy because of the circumstance in which it was recorded.
Which is also, like, just such an interesting science fiction thing too. Like, that's something that I've seen in other science fiction works. I put some of this in Phobos and Deimos too. It feels like there was this sort of, and, like, we don't have robots like this, so who knows whether this will end up being the case or not, but there is almost, I don't want to say consensus, but there's a widespread thought that if you were to build an artificial intelligence, it would need to be trained or raised in a similar way to a human child, where who you are is based on, like, the connections you make in your brain, that there needs to be this, like, extended learning phase. And yeah, so I like seeing a story like that, because it feels like, oh, this is someone who's actually read a lot of things on this topic.
This felt very like, I don't know, it still felt very connected to kind of where we are currently in this moment, because, you know, there's definitely people that think that the future of humanity is where we can like upload all of our thoughts onto like a chip and, you know, migrate our consciousness into computer. I think that's this whole push for like why we need to keep pushing all this AI stuff, because like, and why we need like these Neuralink chips and stuff, because like we have to like put our brains inside of computers and like abandon like the real world, basically. I mean, I don't agree to any of this, but like this is sort of what people talk about, and it's interesting to sort of see a less awful interpretation of that technology. Like this idea of copying your brain onto a computer is like a really fascinating concept, but it is one that like, I don't know, it's like I found myself thinking a lot about, you know, like for the purposes of this story, it's like Al has been resurrected thanks to this technology. But like I find myself with stuff like this, I think like, well, the being that was Al died and is gone. And so like all of his memories were copied into this android, and now, you know, there's another being walking around with Al's memories, talking and acting like Al, and ostensibly Al has returned, but like I don't know, I feel like there's still this like break in continuity that, for me, it's like, I don't know, it doesn't address the soul, right? It's like I don't know if like when people talk about like we need to just upload our minds onto computer chips and we'll live forever, it's like, well, no, some other entity might experience some kind of a life, but like when your brain neurons stop firing, you're done. Like for you, it's over. Like we can copy all that stuff over, but like you're, I don't know, it's like I don't think it's like this seamless consciousness moving from one to the other. Like your soul doesn't migrate into the machine, right? If that,
Yeah, well, there's
I don't
this
know if I'm
deep
making any sense.
conversation to be had about is the soul, is your humanity, your neural pathways, or is it more?
Yeah, and it's interesting that Al is the character that this happens to because he is almost weirdly okay with that. Like, I'm, that is not something you could say about every person in the world that they would be okay with this happening. Like, Al seems like to generally, like, it's not that it doesn't affect him at all to realize that he is not in his original body. He is a copy. Like, his brain is also a copy. And not, we don't know for sure that it's 100%. But he kind of just, maybe it's because he, of the, like he doesn't seem to place a high value on himself from the get-go.
Certainly
And
not his body.
and so the transferring and becoming a robot or a robot copy is just another day. Like it's a weird day, but it's something he can get past.
It's also something that he was dedicating himself to.
Yeah.
So, this future where it is possible to resurrect someone in a robot body is something that he had dedicated a lot of emotional and time and intelligent energy too.
Yeah, so he at some, and we never see this in the comic, but one could assume that he has probably thought about, would I ever do this myself? And
Sure.
already come up with some answers.
Yeah, definitely. And like projecting, like, if this were an option for myself, would I take it and how would I take it? I
Yeah,
thought
the
something that Blue did really well with this comic, coming back to the history of robotics and the pursuit of artificial intelligence, let's call it, that was, I think it was present in 2019, definitely, but Blue did a really good job of picking up on it and how technology works. So originally, in the beginning of the story, Al is making a robot chassis, right? A large, giant robot automaton thing. And then later they shift focus to the emulator and they interact with other people who are making other robotic components. And I thought that was very, very true. So if you look at the trajectory of robotics now, like we have people who are focusing on robot faces, we have people who are focusing on programming in terms of like how a robot can learn to move its own body. And then you have robots that are very focused on dexterity, like Atlas. And these robots don't have the same kind of artificial intelligence. They've decided to let other people deal with that and just focus on mobility. And I thought that was really cool. So the fact that Alan Brendan focused only on the emulator was a really smart way to take the plot.
Yeah, I mean you're much more in this world than either of us, but so I'm curious of your thoughts on this, but at least to me it seems like a very authentic depiction of the way the tech industry works.
In
Like
parts.
these in parts, okay.
In parts. There's a sense of scale, right? It would not work well for the plot, but the scale of what one or two or five people could accomplish was a little bit off. But other than that, like in terms of what they are focusing on and what types of skills they would need to have and how they would prioritize their time and how they would set up the project to progress, all of that felt pretty good. Yeah.
Cool. All right, we have a whole other episode to talk about stuff. How are we feeling so far about Oh Human Star?
I mean, like I said, I picked this up when it was first published and was immediately enraptured and read it and loved it. And then I was really excited when Volume 2 finally came out. And then I've been so busy, I didn't know there was a Volume 3 until very recently. And now I'm very happy that I have my complete set. And I'm very excited to talk about 2 and 3.
I love this book. I think everyone should read it. And if this hasn't, if this episode, if you jumped into this episode not having read O Human Star, definitely, if anything we're talking about piqued your interest, it's worth it. Just go dive in.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of assume when we record these, like, oh, we're talking to an audience that has read the book we're talking about. I'm sure that's not the case all the time. If you have not read Human Star, I'm gonna, yeah, like go read it before episode two.
We are going to spoil the hell out of Volume 2 and 3, so just like be forewarned.
Yes,
Yeah.
it's worth it. It's all online. You can get PDFs instantaneously and just do yourself the favor.
Yeah. Okay, cool. All right, so our next episode is obviously going to be on volumes 2 and 3. Do we have shout outs?
Yes. I have been watching Pantheon on Netflix, and I'm reminded that this, a lot of what we've been talking about uploaded intelligence and artificial intelligence and AI and this and that, if you want to see a lot of these same concepts explored but in a more horror way, there's an 8-series animated TV show called Pantheon on Netflix that I highly recommend.
I'm gonna shout out Everything Sucks by Noah Millions. I was given this as a Christmas gift, and it's a Silver Sprocket comic. And even though it's a floppy, it's got foil, like green foil on the cover. And it's just like a fun, quirky little story about anthropomorphic people that basically live in the same world we do. And I don't know, it was just quirky. I liked it.
All right, I'm going to shout out a science fiction novel. This is another book I read recently that has a lot to say about the idea. This is pre the current quote unquote AI stuff again. So it's still part of the same conversation as like, what would it be like to have an artificial intelligence? Like, what if there was a singularity? What would happen? It doesn't have maybe as much heart as O Human Star, but it has a lot of interesting ideas for sure. It's called Saturn's Children by Charles Stross, and it's basically set in a future world where humanity is extinct, and the ones who survive are all robots. And they still have plenty to keep themselves busy. They still have a whole world going on. The Trade Raiders is presented by Cloudscape Comics. We'd like to thank Sleuth for the music. You can find many more episodes wherever you find podcast episodes. Thanks for listening.